Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. When the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon was ordained to the Episcopal priesthood in 1982, I cannot imagine that she foresaw the challenges that lay ahead. As she assumed ever-increasing responsibilities, including leadership of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C., the church was faced with conflict and divisiveness on issues, including the role of women and lesbian gay persons. As the second woman consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, she never shied away from addressing these issues, and in addition, she found time to participate in important interfaith work as well. And I should also say that she kept in touch with her parishioners and acted as a comforter and encourager as well. Now, her interfaith work, fortunately for us, included serving as chair of the Board of Interfaith Alliance, as well as, after retirement, a staff position with the Interfaith Alliance. Bishop Jane retired from the Episcopal Church in 2002, but she continues to be a trailblazer in the areas that need her inclusive spirit the most. With warm congratulations on receiving this year's Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, I'm so very pleased to welcome the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon back to State of Belief Radio. Jane, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, Welton.
Winona, Mississippi. You say Winona in Mississippi, where you grew up as a child, to Washington, D.C., where you served as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, to Oxford University and other such venues of heady importance. That's a long way. I say that because you and I have talked so many times about the commonalities in our pilgrimage. So I want to ask you a question right off that's the most asked question to which I have to respond. It may not be grammatically correct, but it's a good question. How did you get here from where you came from?
How did I get here? Well, my family asked me that quite often. I was blessed, Welton, to grow up in a family where religion was central. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, U.S., as we used to say, and church attendance on Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, Wednesday night prayer meeting were part of our lifestyle. We all went, my mother, my father, my grandparents, my brother, and my sister. So that part of my religious formation began at birth and has continued, and I will always be grateful for that. I grew up in the 40s and the 50s, and in the 50s when I went away to college in 1955 to school in Virginia, Randolph Macon Women's College, the civil rights movement was stirring and beginning. Dr. King was beginning to lead in Birmingham and was reading about that in the paper. It had never really impacted my life. However, I transferred to Vanderbilt University in 1958. And was blessed to be there during the time that the sit-ins had moved from Greensboro, North Carolina, to Nashville. I met a man who was a senior in law school when I was a senior in undergraduate school, David Dixon, to whom I've been married now for 51 years. And I often say that he took my hand and led me into the movement for human rights. He had the Constitution in one hand and the Bible in the other. We were fortunate to move into an Episcopal church there in Nashville where the rector had wonderful meetings on Sunday afternoons in the basement of the church where African-American clergy would come. We would meet. We would talk about what we were seeing. And so that journey began where I could see the civil rights movement, human rights, and how that related to the gospel. Mm-hmm. My husband and I got very enthralled with President Kennedy and decided that we would come to Washington to be a part of the new frontier. Tragically for us as well as for the country and the world, the president was assassinated before we got here. But we came ahead, arrived here in the spring of 1964. Once again, we got involved with the Episcopal Church, and the rector there at the time was very involved in human rights movement, and so that continued. And how I got there is the church was the place where I acted out, literally, my move into the women's movement. again, the inclusion of all people, and began to meet people who were openly gay and lesbian, and connecting the gospel to what I believe is God's call for the dignity and worth of every human being. It progressed from there. The Episcopal Church began to ordain women in 1974, irregularly, but by the time I went to seminary in 1977, the Episcopal Church had voted to ordain women. I went to seminary in 77, and as you said, I was ordained in 82.
Jane, back to Winona.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it was like in Paris, Tennessee. I went to church every time the door was open. My parents took me the second Sunday after I was born. But I have to say that in that church, I didn't hear much challenge of the things that were wrong. I try to look back honestly, and I can't always tell whether I really did question what was going on or whether that's a feeling that I have now rather than that I had then. Did you ever, growing up there, feel like something's missing, something's wrong here?
I don't really think so, Wilton. I think, like you, that that was just part of life. That's how it was. The few things that I can remember along the way is a woman who worked in our home as a domestic had a son who was a year older than I. And before we were 6 years old, we played together. I went to his birthday parties. He never came to mine, but then it stopped my going to his birthday party. And I can remember saying, why can't I go to his birthday party? That kind of thing. I didn't question much, but I got to college, and again, there was very little being said about civil rights in Lynchburg, Virginia. I mean, I was reading about Dr. King and, of course, the hideous situation with Emmett Till taking place in Mississippi began to hit me as something was drastically wrong. But growing up, there was very little of that.
Well, I think you've taken us where I wanted to go, because I wanted to find out, where did that first impulse to change, where did that come from, the impulse to not be the same as what you had seen around you in childhood, to grow? Did it come from parents or community? Did it come inside the church or outside the church? Where did it come from?
Well, it came in large part, as I say, for this man that I met at Vanderbilt when we started dating one another in the fall of 1958. And those conversations that these law students were having about the movement that was taking place in Nashville, as we watched Diane Nash and others having the courage to go down and confront people in downtown Nashville. The church, as I say, by then my husband and I were interested in, but when we married in 1960, becoming Episcopalians, because we could talk about it there. We couldn't talk about it in the church that I grew up in. I never heard any of that. And the thing that happened in my family, when I think back on it, was my father had been very active in on the school board of the public schools in Winona. And when finally they decided to enforce Brown versus the Board of Education in the 60s, after I was married, living in Nashville, they started the White Flight School in Winona. And they had wanted my father to become chair of the board, and he refused. And so that was another step along the way, this journey, to see my father, who was, as I love him dearly, but he was racist. Mm-hmm. But for him, education was central. Mm-hmm. And to say that only certain people could go to school in that very definite way, he couldn't do that. So that made a huge impact on me. And, of course, when we moved to Washington in 64 and could see persons of color who were very active, who were active in the church, it all began to fall into place for me.
As a young woman coming out of Winona, Mississippi, I'm interested in what your mindset was. Did you ever entertain the idea that you might in your life be a part of major change in the American religious community and in the civil rights situation in this nation?
The only thing that ever happened was when I was probably a sophomore in high school, man who continues to be my oldest and dearest friend in the whole world, said to me one day, because as you said, I was there every time the church doors opened. I enjoyed it. I went to church camp. And one day he said to me, "You know what, Jane, you ought to be a preacher." And we laughed. Interestingly, that stuck in my mind when I was writing to the bishop to see whether he would consider me for ordination. But that was, you know, that was just a once, one-time happening. In terms of the civil rights movement, no. That did not happen until we left Nashville. My husband and I knew that we needed to get away from the South to be able to live into some of the things that we believed in.
Right. When did you decide to study for the ministry?
I was confronted by a woman who's a great mentor in my life, Dr. Verna Dozier, woman, African-American woman here in Washington, who was head of the English department for the D.C. Public Schools, whom I met on a task force for Christian education for the diocese. And I was telling her at lunch one day that I was sure that our son David, who was at the time 12 or 13, was going to be a priest. And she looked at me and she said, "Listen here, if you want to be a priest, you do it, but you leave that boy alone." It was one of those epiphanies, and that boy loved her all her life, I can assure you. He is not a priest. I still think he'd be a wonderful priest, but that's not going to happen. But that's when it was really put to me again about the seriousness of whether or not, and as I say, the Episcopal Church was changing, the doors were opening, I was confronted, I was getting support from the diocese.
So where did the desire come from? Now, and I'm being respectful of, because I know you well, a sense of the leadership of God, I know would be a part of the answer to this question. But how did that second plant of the idea grow into you actually saying, maybe this is right?
Well, that lunch that I told you about took place outside of Philadelphia at Bryn Mawr. We were there at a conference, and I rode the train home shortly after that, and my husband picked me up at Union Station, and I told him what Dr. Dozier had said to me, and I thought he was going to laugh and say, "Well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard." And what he said was, "I think she may be right." That was the second step of validation. And then in the Episcopal Church, we are asked in the ordination vows, "Do you believe that God and the church are calling you to ordination?" I hope and pray that God is calling me. But the church has called me. They have respected that call. The bishop sent me to seminary for a year to see whether or not that was, in fact, what I was being called to do. The diocese had a program where we met with lay people who worked with us to help us examine our call. I was supported by them. The bishop gave me postulancy. As I say, the steps have sort of fallen into place, and that's how it's taken place for me, was that I was validated or verified by people along the way. And as I say, I hope that it's God's wish as well.
See, I understand that so very well, because I was never sure whether it was God or my mother calling me to the ministry. And so I appreciate you being honest about that. So once the decision was made, and I am not surprised at all to hear that your husband, whom I call Dixie, was that insightful and supportive, did you have to go back to school at that point?
Mm-hmm. I had graduated from Vanderbilt with a BA in 59. We were married in there in Nashville, and I got an MAT in 62. But the Episcopal Church generally requires that you do a three-year seminary. So in 1977, I went to Virginia Theological Seminary. Again, that first year was a discerning year. And after that, I took a year to be a part of a process that the Diocese of Washington had. And in the spring of 1989, the Bishop of Washington made me a postulant, which is the first step toward ordination. And so then I received a Master of Divinity, 1981.
Jane, what did they not tell you in seminary you wish they had?
Lots. I'll tell you, Welton, right now, as I'm 74 years old, and they really never prepared me in seminary for what it was going to be like to be a support, to be a priest, to be a pastor to people like myself who are aging, whose bodies are failing. That's the thing that stands in my mind the most right now, is that part of my ministry as a retired person, but still I'm very honored when people call for me. They did not tell me that canon law was going to be important for me, living within a system of jurisdiction and what that would really mean as I became a bishop and had to be a governance officer, so to speak. They did not prepare me for that. And they didn't really prepare me, I don't think, for the world and the political world of the church.
Yeah, that's the political world of the church. Mm-hmm. I've often said, though I'm actually having to rethink it in the last several months here in D.C. watching our Congress, but I've often said some of the dirtiest politics I've ever seen were in the church. The only ones dirtier were in universities. Is that your experience too?
Well, I don't have the university experience. I've been on the board of a seminary and have seen something not like what you're talking about. But yes, there are very ugly things that happen in the church. And what I have to tell myself every night is we've all fallen short of the glory of God. We're human beings. And why I thought it was going to be any better in the Episcopal Church than it was in Winona, Mississippi, is not correct. And I've seen people do things to others and have participated in some things myself that I'm not proud of.
Sure. It does seem, though, I have to say, knowing both of us, that it seems some fell shorter of the glory of God than others.
Well, I'll let you say that.
Jane, was there a moment or were there moments when in this pilgrimage you felt you were at a crossroads, that you had to make a clear decision, when you had to choose maybe your heart and your conscience in the face of opposition? Or was it like that, or was it more a matter of just many small decisions over the years and decades?
Well, it's interesting, Welton, when you asked me that about the decisions, somehow people must have told me, I must have known that when I was in seminary that last year, that I took an independent study with the Reverend Dr. Richard Bush on how the church responds to abortion and how the church responds to the inclusion of gay and lesbian persons, which was a major issue for me. He had me read theologians. He had me read sociologists. He had me read the Bible. And we talked about that at great length because, as he said to me, these are going to be, or I knew when I asked him for that, these were going to be two issues that I was going to have to face. And particularly the ordination of gay and lesbian persons came about as I was president of the Standing Committee in the Diocese of Washington for the ordination of the first openly lesbian woman in a committed relationship, about could we accept her, would we stand with her for ordination with the bishop.
How did it happen for you to become a bishop? I mean, did you want that?
Well, I had often said I was too old. I was not ordained until I was 43 years old. So I was not a young person when this came about, and it never occurred to me that, given my life that I would have in the church, that I would be a bishop. A number of people had said to me sort of along the way, we could see you do this. And as I say, the church has sort of led me on my way. And I had said in Washington when Ronald Haynes became the diocesan bishop, they were looking for a dean. He was looking for a dean at the Washington Cathedral Church of St. Peter and St. Paul. And then he called for the election of an assistant bishop, a suffragan bishop. And I had said publicly that I thought that a person of color needed to be in a very prominent position in this diocese. This diocese has worked hard for inclusion for many, many years. And when the Right Reverend Nathan Baxter was appointed dean of the cathedral, an African-American man, I got a call. actually, from an African-American lawyer. He said, well, that piece has been taken care of. Now, I want you to think seriously about having your name put in for a suffragan bishop. And so I began to think, actually, I have to go back. My name was in for bishop in North Carolina, for suffragan bishop in North Carolina before Washington. Mm. And a woman I'd been in seminary with put my name in down there. Mm. And Dr. Dozier and some other people who were great mentors for me said, I think you ought to look at this. And a woman who had been in the process in Washington when Ron Haynes was elected suffragan in 86 said to me, Jane, do it, because if it does nothing else for you, what it will do, it will help you to articulate what you believe about God and the church. Hmm. And if you learn to be able to do that and be able to say it with clarity, it will help you.
That's a good segue into the next question, because I'd like for you to pick a couple of issues, if you will, or turning points in your work within the Episcopal Church that particularly stand out as you look back at your ministry within that church. These could be either victories or maybe less than victories, but moments for which you're grateful today because you had a place at the table and you could do what you've just talked about doing.
Well, the Reverend Elizabeth Carl came to the diocese. She came through the process, was approved by John Walker as a postulant, Bishop John Walker. There was a concern about the fact that she was open about her sexuality. She was in a longtime partnership. And whether or not we would approve her in the Episcopal system, the standing committee as well as the bishop have to approve persons for ordination past that first procedure. And so I was there at the table, and she is one of the most committed, faithful Christian persons I've ever known. But there was great controversy about her ordination. The presiding bishop was very anxious about this. The cathedral was very anxious about this. And so I had the privilege of being one of the bishop's chaplains. I was not a bishop at that time. On that night at Church of the Epiphany, to say that we do believe that all persons are created in the image of God. That was one that stands out for me, and that I'll always be grateful I had the chance to be there. The other was when I was the ecclesiastical authority in 2000, Ron Haynes, Bishop of Washington, retired. And our polity says that the suffragan becomes the ecclesiastical authority with the retirement or the death of a bishop until a new bishop is elected. And so I was presented with a situation with a congregation in the diocese who wanted to call a rector who would not promise that he would be faithful to his ordination vows. And in our church, we say that you promise to obey the bishop and that you will stay within the diocese. And this is a man who had written extensively about the work of a rector was to take the church to take churches out of the Episcopal system, that we were, in his language, this is a quote, going to hell in a handbasket. And Ron Haynes retired, and that was left on my plate. I saw my work, my ministry, my job was to protect and defend the Diocese of Washington. I had taken those vows when I was ordained a bishop. And it was difficult. There were people who had major disagreements about what we should do. The Episcopal Church does not really have a judicial system. We're pretty good on the legislative and the representative side, but judicial we don't have much of. And he wouldn't leave the congregation. And I had no recourse but to go to the civil court. And the federal judge ruled in my favor, then they appealed it, and then the federal circuit court approved the first decision. That was important to me because, as I said, we've all fallen short of the glory of God, and I'm convinced that we have to have structures in which to live. And unless we change those structures, we live within them. I'm a beneficiary of the structure that changed to allow the ordination of women, so yeah. I don't consider myself hidebound. On the other hand, when we say certain things, we have to live within those. And to allow churches to become renegade, I felt was not what was being called for or that was going to be faithful.
That was a tough time, wasn't it, during that civil suit?
It was a tough time. I had the support of the Standing Committee of the Diocese. I had the support of the Diocesan Council of the Diocese, all except one person. I had a wonderful team of people who were working with me, advising me. I had you who were there for me, many phone calls between the two of us. I had clergy who were talking with me about this, and I had probably the most intense prayer life of my entire life.
Listen, we got to take a break, but I have to ask you, because in this context is the time to do it, about that pledge that you got to obey the bishop. Did your husband, Dixie, have to take that pledge?
My husband did not have to take that pledge. And when I was going through the process for ordination, Bishop Walker said to me, "Jane Dixon, you're going to promise not once but twice to obey me. And I know you didn't promise to obey David Dixon when you married him. And he certainly doesn't have to obey. What's that going to mean for you?"
Oh, we're just getting started with the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, a recipient of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award given by Interfaith Alliance, and a lifelong trailblazer for the cause of inclusion and celebration of diversity, both within and beyond the Episcopal Church. Jane, what have been some of the most discouraging moments in your ministry? We've just talked one before the break about the civil lawsuit. What about in the whole breadth of your ministry? Where has the difficulty come?
Well, it makes me sad in the church that we have not had more opportunities for African-American persons. Because we have fewer African-American persons who are presenting themselves for ordination, fewer Latino folk, because churches that tend to call a person of color as their rector, the chief pastor, they may be there. There may not be other opportunities. There's not the mobility. Now, that continues to make me sad. We have fewer bishops of color. So that's been one of the things that I think has been a sadness. The other thing for me, as you know, Welton, mainline Protestant churches are declining. All the statistics show that. And I say to myself, how is it that we are not preaching the gospel to folk to see it as life transforming? What's happening? What are we doing? And I take responsibility for that myself. That causes me enormous sadness and questions that I ask every day. I would say those are the two that bother me the most.
How did you get to be involved in interfaith activism?
When I was at St. Albans Church in the late 79, when I went to be a seminarian there, St. Albans Church, right up here on Mount St. Alban, was involved with Washington Hebrew Congregation, as well as the Roman Catholic Church down the street. And one of the things that the rector had me do as part of my training was to be involved in that. And so I got to know folk, particularly at Washington Hebrew. I came back to St. Albans in the mid-80s to be the associate rector, and that was part of my job description. And so I began to work particularly with Washington Hebrew, and when I became rector out in Laurel, there was a group from the Washington Hebrew congregation who came to celebrate my institution as rector. A wonderful friendship. Then in Laurel, the Desert Storm came about. And it seemed important to me that we in that Episcopal Church, which was down on the main street of Laurel, to have a prayer service and to invite all the faith traditions that were in that community. And they were gracious enough to come. It was a very important time, I thought, for us to be together to respect and honor one another. When I was elected bishop, our ecumenical and interfaith work became part again of my job description. Bishop Haynes gave me that privilege. And so I began to work with religious leaders here in Washington. And as you know, as the Interfaith Alliance was getting started, people came to talk to me about that. And so it went from there. And to me, the goodness of that, and as I think you know, our daughter converted to Judaism. And so interfaith relationship became personal as well as the work that I had done.
You had the good fortune of interfaith ministry actually being an extension of your life within the Episcopal Church. There are many people who don't have that
right.
in their traditions. I think the interfaith movement, of course, is one of the significant changes that has happened in the Anglican Church and in many churches, many denominations in Christianity over the last few years. I'm curious as to when you look at the big picture, how different does the Christian religion look today than it looked when you got started in ministry?
Well, I have to look at that on many different ways, but in terms of the interfaith, I mean, that was – I do not remember a course in Virginia Seminary being offered. I'm sure that people studied religious – different religions in undergraduate schools. I took some – we thought it was pretty out there to take a course at Catholic University. That was the only place that liberation theology was being taught back in the late 70s. But in terms of real interaction with Jewish brothers and sisters, Muslim brothers and sisters, now, within the Diocese of Washington, that was not true. Bishop Walker and some others had formed the interfaith group here. The Reverend Clark Lobenstein heads that. So that was becoming part of life in the Diocese of Washington. So that was supported by that. But now it's clergy are encouraged to learn about that in seminary. We always stressed when I was at the diocese that clergy work with ministers of other religions, where it was maybe it happened if you happened to be with a priest who was doing that. But now it's I think it's for I can speak best about the Episcopal Diocese of Arden. It's encouraged, but it's true in many dioceses across this country. The Bishop of Los Angeles is a major participant in interreligious work. And so you see it on a regular basis. And of course, our relationships with people throughout the world, given the travel, the ease of travel these days, the internet, all of that. And we've learned that this is important for our life.
Different churches face different challenges. So I know that there's no one size fits all answer to this next question. But if you could give one piece of hard-earned advice to activists within the Episcopal and other churches and faith communities who are working right now to open more doors, to tear down more barriers, faithfully include more people in the life of those communities, what would that advice be? And I want you to set that, I guess, in the context of what do you wish you had known when you started in interfaith work and opening doors of inclusion that you don't know now, or that you do know. I should say that. What do you know now that you didn't know when you started in that work?
I believe, Welton, that there are more folk who are willing to be engaged in these conversations than we think. I think to sit there and think, well, they're not really willing to interact with me because we have different views on theology. I just don't think that's true. I think that people want to be engaged with one another. And I think if I would give any advice to anybody, it's to reach out a hand. People can only tell you no. But the important thing is so many more people are willing, I believe, to tell you yes. Now, I'm a blessed person. My introduction back in the late 70s was to a Jewish congregation who were open mm-hmm. to having that conversation with me and helping me form as an Episcopal priest. Now, that's not everybody's good fortune, and I know that. But it was certainly my work in Laurel, Maryland, to work with the congregation there. In fact, I had the rabbi read the scripture, the Hebrew scripture, at my consecration in 1992. He came and did that for me because I wanted to make that, I wanted that to be a part of it. So I think that there's more goodwill out there, and I just think it takes that risk, and I will sort of tout the horn of the Episcopal Church. I think we've been better about that than some other mm-hmm. religious traditions.
Yeah. Well, I know that one sign of wisdom in the Episcopal Church is that they regularly ask you to speak with young ministers, especially young women ministers studying for the priesthood. Would you talk with first-year seminarians or people who are on their way to ordination? What do you tell them you think the biggest challenges of the future will be for them?
That's a really interesting question and one that's very hard to answer. I think it goes back to what I said, that one of the great sadnesses or disappointments for me is, why are we not being able to tell the story, as politicians would say, our narrative? Why are we not being able to tell that with the power and the life-changing ability that it certainly has had on my life? Mm-hmm. And how are they going to be in today's world and to do that? To do it faithfully, because one of the things I learned at the Interfaith Alliance, as well as with the other interfaith work I have done, it doesn't take away from my Christianity. It doesn't diminish it at all to be in conversation with people of other religious traditions. That woman told me about the episcopate, it makes me learn to articulate what I believe. And so that's what I would say and what I have said to persons on the way toward ordination and those four young priests that I mentored for 2 years is, how are you going to get that message out? And I think so much of it is not only telling it, but living it.
Jane, what do you think about today?
What do I think about today?
Yeah, what are you thinking these days? Is it looking back on your ministry? Is it looking at what's going on around us? Is it so? I mean, I know you read broadly, and I'm just wondering what you're thinking about.
Well, I'm very excited, Welton, because the Diocese of Washington has just elected a new bishop. She will be consecrated on the 12th of November. Female, the Reverend Dr. Mary Ann Edgar Buddy. And what I think about is, how is this young woman going to lead this church into the future? She's a faithful Christian person. She's brilliant. And so I think a lot about the hope that I have, that these questions that I have, that this is a person who knows how to blog, who knows how to use new forms of communication. So I think about that. I think about our country a lot, our place in the world. I worry about the fact that we seem to be becoming mean-spirited, that we are really not much interested in loving our brothers and sisters as ourselves. And what can I, as a retired 74-year-old woman, do about that? I think about that every day. I do sometimes go back and yearn for the days when it seemed to me to be more simple, that the issues of civil rights and women's rights and the acceptance of gay and lesbian people seemed to be more clear-cut, and so the struggle was easier. I think about all this occupying Wall Street or Freedom Plaza and the folk that are out there. How are they going to get focused and really make a difference? Because the inequity, the economic inequity in this world is tragic. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I think about.
What's the one question you wish I'd asked you today, but I didn't ask you?
What has given me the support and the strength to do what the goodness that I've been led into?
So why don't you answer that?
Well, as I said to you, I am blessed with a man, my husband, for these many years, who is a faithful Christian, a wonderful human being who loves me enough to tell me the truth. I've had incredible mentors, and I've had a rich prayer life. My prayer life is probably not like a lot of other people's, but it has sustained me through days and helps me every day. But it's that interaction with one of the things that I have known is the Episcopal Church, one of our central tenets, of course, is the Incarnation. Mm-hmm. And I have found that if I'm faithful, that God will bring someone into my life when I need that person to either open a door, to help me see another perspective. And so those are the things that have given me the strength and the courage. When you ask me, what did people say? How did this happen for you? How did you get here? Is that that's been true for me.
I've been speaking with the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, the second woman consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, a resolute leader, a courageous dissident when the need arose, and a trailblazer for the cause of inclusion both within and beyond her church. In the tradition from which I come, we observe in the fall Reformation Sunday, a time for looking at what's going on in the church, and that's closely associated with a holiday that is important in the Anglican Church, which is All Souls Day, of remembering people who have gone before us. One Sunday on Reformation Sunday and All Souls Day in our congregation, I started naming the people whom I look to as heroes. I start naming people who in my tradition are the heroes, heroines of the Reformation and continuing the Reformation. And I think I told you, but I want to tell our listeners, Jane Holmes Dixon is on that list, and she is very worthy of being there, and she is one of the people that gives strength and hope to people who look at religion and sometimes say, what in the heck is going on? And they see her, and they know that something really good is going on. Bishop Jane, congratulations again on receiving the Faith and Freedom Award named after Walter Cronkite, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. I'm honored, and thank you for those incredible words. It means a lot to me.
The Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards will be given by Interfaith Alliance at a gala dinner in New York City on Sunday evening, November 13th. If you'd like to attend, we'd love to have you. Please visit interfaithalliance.org for complete information.